We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Untangle, the meditation podcast from Gaiam. I'm your host, Patricia Karpus. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who have devoted their lives to teaching and helping others through meditation. In today's episode, I sat down with James Fox, founder of the Prison Yoga Project. This project was founded in the belief that yoga and mindfulness can bring about change in prisoners who've been impacted by chronic trauma for most of their lives. His work has taken him inside San Quentin, where he's taught some of their most violent offenders. Here's his story. James, welcome to our podcast. Thank you so much for coming in today.
I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah. So I've done a little bit of research on you. And I have to say, over the last couple of days, I've been emotionally connected to the work that you've been doing. I even surprised myself. I think I changed how I feel about the prisoner population a little bit just from really trying to understand the work you do and your motivation for doing that work. So I want to start with understanding who you were as a kid. You know, I want to understand the context for what inspires you to this work ultimately.
Yeah. I grew up in Chicago, and I grew up in Chicago during a period of time when there was a lot of violence. And although I grew up in a good family, I had a lot of support from my parents and grew up in a solid family. I grew up in an environment and in a community where violence, particularly violence among men or among boys, was accepted behavior. And it wasn't until later when I became a young man that I realized that that kind of conditioning really had paid a price for me, that I felt that I had an anger problem.
Mm. So and you became part of that, the group whose culture was violent, if you will, violence?
Yes, unknowingly.
Yeah.
It was just accepted.
It
was just part of the culture. It was accepted behavior. Fighting if you got challenged was accepted behavior. There wasn't a question of backing down. If you know, and I think this is part of something that, through the work that I've been doing with prisoners over the years, not only teaching yoga, but some of the other work that I've done in violence prevention work, of understanding that there's this male role belief system that the majority of men in this culture grow up with, that is, it's okay to be violent. I would say that there were several situations in my life as a young man where I realized I've got to make a change. And it was recognizing that this reactive part of myself that was so quick to react without foresight, without the ability to back off, was going to eventually get me into trouble.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what shifted you from being this guy with an anger culture within to being someone that wanted to serve others with anger and violence as a part of their lives?
Well, there was always this place within me, there was always this active part of myself. Call it my higher consciousness.
Where did that come from? Were you a religious child?
Or yeah, that came from seeker? That came from my upbringing of having been raised a Catholic, and I was an altar boy when I was 10, 11, and 12 years old,
mm-hmm.
and had my own experiences as a boy, spiritual experiences on my own, separate from religion, separate from being a Catholic, realizing that there was something much greater than me and my personality. So I always had that. And so that's what really balanced out this unpleasant personality aspect of me that most of all the people that I grew up with had, but that I really decided, no, I don't want to live my life this way. I want to make a change.
Yeah.
When I first started doing yoga, I was going through a lot of emotional difficulty in my life. And I actually originally started practicing yoga because I had an injury. And when somebody mentioned yoga to me, I would say, yoga? Why would I do yoga? Yoga's for women. And finally, I went to a yoga class. And I realized immediately the emotional and the psychological value of the practice. The physical value of the practice was like icing on the cake. I was already in good physical shape other than this injury that I had. But what impacted me most was how calm I felt as a result of the practice and how much peace of mind it brought me. And so, in a sense, it became my self-therapy, dealing with a lot of the emotional difficulties that I was dealing with at that time. And I became very committed. And I rather quickly came to realize how much value a yoga practice would have for people who were struggling with emotional difficulties. There came a point in time in my commitment to my practice where I got this message, well, if it's so important to you, I guess you're the one who's supposed to teach it then. And when I became certified as a yoga teacher, which was in 2000, I was very clear that I didn't want to go and teach in a yoga studio,
mm-hmm.
that I wanted to bring yoga to people who wouldn't otherwise be exposed to the practice.
So you chose to focus with at-risk populations to really help them, but you also then take it to the most, what many would consider the most extreme, which is mm-hmm. San Quentin Prison in mm-hmm. California, where some of the most dangerous criminals are. And was this the first of the prison yoga project? Was San Quentin that?
San Quentin was the first of the prison yoga project. My first step into this population was teaching at-risk boys. And it just so happened that the town that I live in, north of San Francisco, had a residential facility for boys at risk,
mm-hmm.
boys who'd been court-ordered into this program. And so it was one of the first places I went and offered to volunteer to teach yoga. I felt that yoga had something to offer these youngsters that they weren't getting through their traditional cognitive behavioral therapy. And I felt if I had the opportunity to actually work with them and work with their bodies more than their rational minds, that could provide a way in.
Were you focusing then on things like impulse control and emotional regulation for those kids? Was that sort of what your intention was?
Well, I was basically focusing on, let me show you some tools, let me show you some skills that you can use to deal with difficult emotions when they arise and when they start to take you over. That's what I was generally focusing on. But I hadn't really developed the methodology that I've developed now.
And were you teaching mindfulness or meditation with these kids at that time?
I was. Teaching short periods of mindfulness meditation. And then I started teaching in juvenile halls, a mindfulness meditation program in juvenile halls in the Bay Area, realized that they needed a body-centered component to what it was that they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started teaching yoga. And of course, the way that I look at it is you can't really separate mindfulness from yoga.
Right.
Mindfulness is an inherent part of yoga.
So then you go, after you've worked with the kids, then you go into San Quentin. And I'm just I was a little blown away at some of the stories of your going in there for the first time. And what did that feel like to walk in there, to meet the prisoners? Did they want to take this course? Were they receptive to it? Okay.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great, and this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now, back to our show.
No. No surprise there, right?
So I was asked by another nonprofit organization that was setting up a rehabilitation program at San Quentin. And they wanted to include a mind-body integration component, and they felt that yoga and meditation was the way that they wanted to go. So they asked me if I would be the one who would provide that, and I said yes. And it was a time when this nonprofit was very understaffed, and I got some preliminary introduction to, well, this is San Quentin, but they were just starting out their entire program. And when I first went in to teach the very first class that I taught at San Quentin, I went in alone.
Mm.
I didn't have somebody walk in with me and say, okay, this is where you're going to be teaching. Let me show you the ropes. And, you know, when you go into a prison like San Quentin or any higher security prison, you have to go through all these checkpoints. And you're buzzed through one area, and then you're buzzed out another area.
Was it scary? Were you scared?
I was scared. Yeah. I was scared. And it just so happened that this very first place that I was going to be teaching is, they buzzed me right out onto the yard of the unit where I was going to teach. And I had another 25 feet to go till I went to the classroom. And so the gate clicks, the buzzer buzzes, the gate clicks open. I walk out into the yard. I've got my yoga mat under my arm. There are probably 100 guys on the yard. And as I start walking toward the classroom, I'm hearing whistles and catcalls of, hey, sweetheart, what's that under your arm there? And I thought, oh, can I just get to this classroom and get in the classroom? And I think the first class that I taught, four guys showed up for the class. And later on, I said the four bravest guys in the entire prison showed up for the class.
Right.
And I was nervous. And but as soon as I started the practice, as soon as we started practicing together, that quickly disappeared. I felt very sure I was where I needed to be.
What kind of an impact did you hope to have? Like, when you went in there, what was your intention?
You know, to be honest with you, and again, this is one of these things that I've come to understand about karma yoga. Karma yoga is yoga of service without attachment to the outcome.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then in a major respect, you're doing it first for yourself. Because of the sense of fulfillment that it brings of being of service through yoga, I was really going in there to share what it was that I knew. And if they could get some value out of it, fantastic.
But here you were dealing with, I mean, probably lots of what you had grown up with. You're dealing with
extreme cases.
Extreme cases, addiction,
right.
Murder,
right.
All kinds of violence. And I just can't help but wonder, you know, what was the process from the beginning to then having a lot of men in the classroom?
Right.
And having some of the impact that you've actually had over the last several years.
It's interesting you ask these questions, because what comes most clearly to mind to me was that the second class that I taught, that one of the guys walked into the classroom and he said, "Do you know, last week after the class, I had the best night's sleep that I've had since I've been incarcerated at San Quentin." And it was like, yes, I'm on the right track here. And then what happened? Well, everything in prison spreads by word of mouth. So within a fairly short period of time, I would say within 6 months, the class was full. And word spread throughout the unit that, first of all, this was a safe place, because some of the language that I used, even back then, and language that I've developed, is when we would start the class, I'd say, this is your opportunity to leave prison for the next hour and a half that we're together. This is out of bounds of the rest of the prison. You don't have to deal with prison politics. You don't have to deal with other prisoners, staff. We're here to practice together. And what started out as one class within a year became two classes. And, you know, over time, now there's four different classes in different parts of the prison with four different groups. And I have a waiting list of probably 70 guys now waiting to get into one of the yoga classes. And all the classes I teach the life sentence men who have the possibility of being paroled.
What does that mean, life sentence, but they have the possibility? Is everybody in there lifer in San Quentin?
No.
So you're teaching life sentence.
So the population, San Quentin has 4,300 prisoners. Of the 4,300 prisoners, 729 are on death row. Then there are other prisons within the prison where men don't have much liberty at all. And then about 2,000 of those 4,300 are general population prisoners. And probably 1,200 to 1,500 of them are life sentence or third strikers in California, which means if you have a third felony strike and you're a three striker, mandatory 26 years. So it's just like being life sentence with the possibility of parole. So what that means is, for instance, if you're convicted of second-degree murder and you get a sentence of 16 years to life, what that means is once you've done your 16 years, and if you've been relatively disciplinary-free, you should be able to qualify to go before the parole board and be considered for a release.
So this is helpful for them to learn skills so that if they are released,
coping skills.
When they are released,
absolutely.
These are coping skills. There's this quote from a professor of psychiatry at Boston University who works in trauma. I'm sure you've seen this because this is some of the research that was on your website. But it says, prison is a breeding ground for mental, emotional, and physical distress, experiences of anxiety, depression, fear, distrust. Agitation, hopelessness, grief, and violence can be greatly increased under incarcerated conditions. When you think about that, and then you think these men are getting worse and then potentially being released, these programs have so much really the potential to shift these behaviors in some way.
This is actually one of the big issues of prison reform in this country.
Yeah.
There's two major issues of prison reform in the United States. One is sentencing reform, these mandatory sentences that send nonviolent prisoners to prison for many, many years. And the other is providing programs for prisoners so when they are released, they have life skills, they have coping skills, so that they don't reoffend and return to prison, because the recidivism rate in this country is 60%.
Right. That's what you were saying. It's 60%, and you had written somewhere that you That's because prison is such a huge industry and they're not focused at all on rehabilitation.
There's not enough rehabilitative programming. Now, San Quentin is an exception to that. And it is an exception to that because it's in the Bay Area. It's in the San Francisco Bay Area and has this history of people bringing all kinds of programs, volunteer programs, into the prison. Mm-hmm. So it's an exception. And in reality, if the rest of the prisons in the U.S. were run like San Quentin, the recidivism rate wouldn't be 60%. It would be much lower.
Do you stay in touch ever with some of the men that are released that you've taught for years?
I do. A number of them, actually. It's on them to contact me. Mm-hmm. It's like I'm not going to chase them down.
Yeah.
It's on them to contact me. The first things a prisoner has to deal with when they're released is, where am I going to live? I got to get a job. I'd like to reunite with my family. They're not going to rush off and start classes in a yoga studio, which was one of the reasons why I wrote my book.
Right.
I wrote my book for prisoners so they would have something that they could use to continue their practice. So a number of my former students stay in touch with me, and I stay in touch with them as well. And a number of them are doing remarkable work.
And do you think they continue with meditation, for example, at home, even if they can't do yoga at home? Do they have
what they tell me is that the things that they learned in yoga class, particularly the self-regulation skills, mm-hmm. the impulse control skills, or the way that they put it is the ability to hit the pause button, is what they carry with them into their lives. And whether they're able to do much asana practice or not, they all say, I continue to use the self-reflective practices that I learned through my yoga classes with you. I use them all the time. In fact, maybe even more now that I'm out because the challenges are so much greater.
It's so much easier to get triggered. We've interviewed a lot of kids who are learning mindfulness in schools, and it just makes me think how much better these men would be had they learned these skills early on in their lives. I mean, I just want to read this other letter that someone wrote to you. Dear Mr. Fox, I'm currently incarcerated at federal prison camp at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. Someone gave me a copy of your book, Yoga, A Path for Healing and Recovery, and about a year ago. It's changed my life, both physically and spiritually. We formed a yoga class and have been doing really well. We're allowed to practice in our visitation room 4 nights a week and on the weekends, and sometimes even in our meditation garden. I wanted to let you know how helpful your book has been. And just wanted to let you know how well it is going for us. Thank you for everything you do and for your commitment. I'm guessing you get a lot of letters like this.
Yes.
And starting to expand your programs around the country.
I'm very humbled by that. And I do get a lot of letters from prisoners who are able to start programs. The administration allows them to practice together.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
When I started looking at the work that you've done, I think for the last couple of days, I've felt like crying, like, only because, first of all, it just blows my mind how much compassion you have for this population. But also it made me realize how broken so many of these people are and how, you know, they're difficult and traumatic, severely traumatic childhoods have, you know, created their current behavior. And I just had a little sort of shift in how I think about the prisoner population. And I also started thinking about them as children. You know, what were they like as children? And I feel like a lot of what you're doing is maybe tapping into some of that original goodness that might have been there at some time.
It's truly a reflection of arrested development.
Mm.
And the other thing is that people don't understand, because the media has portrayed prisoners in a particular way that have people mostly frightened and feel that, well, they deserve to be in prison, so they're out of my consciousness. Prisoners are a reflection of society. They're a reflection of the society that we live in. They're a reflection of some of our loved ones who are struggling with addiction, who are struggling with mental health issues. They are a reflection of people that we went to school with. They are a reflection of me in some way. It might not be the part of me that I really want to see clearly, but they are a reflection of me. And in most cases, most of the men that I have met had far fewer social opportunities, educational opportunities, healthcare opportunities that I have had in my life. And it's a wonder to me sometimes that they're even alive, given the kinds of traumatic backgrounds that they came from. Now, that's not to say that they should shirk the responsibility for causing the harm that they've caused. And this is all part of the restorative justice model, that part of a person's freedom is recognizing, I've caused harm. What can I do to make amends? And the way that I see yoga is a practice that helps a person become more in touch with themselves. It helps a person become more sensitive with themselves. And if I can become more sensitive with myself, if a person can become more sensitive with themselves, then they can develop empathy. They can become more sensitive to others. And this is new information to a lot of these people. These are things that maybe you and I have heard about through our yoga practice and before that. But this is brand new information to a lot of these folks.
Yeah, I love what you're saying about it, this being a reflection of our culture, and that we are all connected, and that in many ways it is our responsibility. And I go back to, what can we do early in life with children to really help them have the tools that they need to emotionally regulate, or to, you know, be able to react productively in conflict situations when they're triggered. So there's so much work to, in my mind, it's so amazing that yoga and meditation, mindfulness, have become so important today, because I think we can help so many people at so many different ages, at so many different life stages, that, you know, we're just seeing so many great benefits all the way around.
I see that change. I see that evolution over the last 13 years. Absolutely, I see that.
What are some of the biggest challenges that you're facing right now?
I think the biggest challenge is the system. Is working with the system. The system is behind the times. And it's also working with the misconception of yoga. So, and that's, some of that is on us. And when I say that, I say the yoga world, that, you know, yoga, and once again, a lot of this has to do with media too, the way the media has portrayed yoga. Typically, it's, you know, a beautiful studio with white women in fancy clothes. I mean, everybody's heard this over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So there's this feeling of, you know, I'm an administrator at a prison and you start to talk to me about yoga. And it's like, how does that possibly fit with this community of prisoners that are here? And but the science is catching up.
Yeah.
And the research is catching up. And the way that yoga and mindfulness are being applied to returning combat veterans, to, as you were saying, children, to mental health issues, it's catching up. So really it's on us to educate people as to what this is all about. And it's really all about yoga therapy. Mm-hmm. It's about really bonifying the value of yoga therapy and using research to support that. I can tell you this from experience, and that is within the last year and a half, we have been regularly contacted by jails and prisons asking for a yoga program.
Yeah, people are clamoring for this.
That's brand new.
Yeah.
I would like to think that we've done a lot of the groundwork in spreading the word. You know, our book is all over the place in prisons. And we also had this campaign, this promotional campaign that we've run 2 years in a row called Send a Book to a Warden, Donate $50, and Designate the prison warden that you want the book and the DVD sent to. We've probably sent over 100 of those out, and out of the 100, we've gotten about a 7% return. So there have been 7 prisons out of the 100 where they've gotten in touch with us and said, can you help us start a yoga program?
Which is so great.
Yes.
Do you have a particular success story or a story of a prisoner that is super inspiring to you and that would kind of show our listeners the benefits or illustration of the benefits?
I have many success stories, but I'll point to one lifer, a man I'm very, very fond of and I've stayed in touch with. And he's somebody who did 26 years. And in the first part of his sentencing, he was sent to Pelican Bay State Prison, which is the maximum security prison. It's the secured housing unit prison in California, which means you're locked down by yourself 23 hours a day. The hour that you're out is you go out into either a cyclone-infested little space or a concrete space where you can exercise.
So they throw your food in a little window?
They bring your food in, and the only other time you go out is to go to medical. He did 10 years at Pelican Bay Prison. Then he transferred out of Pelican Bay Prison, and he ended up at San Quentin. Some of his friends had gotten into the yoga class and told him about it, and he rather timidly showed up to the yoga class, and he's a Latino guy, and I happen to speak Spanish, so I was able to make this connection with him in Spanish. And the other thing I'd like to say about him is that he was also involved at a program at San Quentin where youth came in on a regular basis, and it was not a scared straight program. It was very much of a respectful program, and he was very instrumental in developing that program, working with youth. And when he was released about 3 years ago, he got a job with the same organization that had been bringing youth into the prison, and he became a youth counselor, and then he became a violence interrupter facilitator in Oakland, California, working in a junior high school and a high school.
Wow.
Giving back.
That's incredible.
Giving back. And he was interviewed not too long ago about what yoga meant to him. And in the interview, he said he was talking about yoga and he was talking about some of the benefits that he experienced from the practice. And he stopped for a minute and he said, you know, yoga allowed me to cry again, to laugh again. He said, yoga allowed me to release the binds that had me while I was in prison so that I began to feel free even though I was still incarcerated.
Wow.
And he said, for that, I'll be forever grateful. And you could tell that he's carrying that on with him in his life.
Wow.
And that's so just great. One story.
You live in this space every day. How do you stay at peace, going, you know, with as much compassion as you have and such strength?
Well, one of the things I say to a number of my colleagues who teach other kinds of classes at San Quentin, they teach group process classes and things like that. I say, well, I'm one of the luckiest guys who comes in here because I get to do yoga with my students. First of all, it's a privilege and it's an honor to be able to be of service to these men. And I say that sincerely. No money could buy the sense of gratitude and fulfillment that I experience from doing the work. So that in and of itself fills my cup. And really get the very clear understanding that we as human beings all really want the same thing. We all want to be acknowledged. We all want human dignity. And we all want to be loved. It's bottom line. I don't care where you're from, what your background is, what you've done. That's what we want. The other thing about it is that because we're doing yoga, I'm consciously aware of the fact that when we're doing particularly asana practice, we are being given the opportunity to discharge the stress and anxiety that's held in the body. So I'm very conscious of that. It's very much of my intention, it's my trauma-informed methodology, that we discharge what's held in the body, and we work with the body wisdom. We don't have to recall in our minds the trauma that we experienced and then say, okay, I guess I'm going to release that. The body has its own wisdom. If we address the body's wisdom, the body will take care of itself and it will discharge stress and anxiety that is the major contributor to reactivating trauma and unresolved trauma. Occasionally, I'm really knocked to my knees. Occasionally, I'll hear a story. Occasionally, I'll see something that is very inhumane. And it'll take me down, and I've got my people who I can go to and speak to them and say, you know, I gotta speak with you. I got to let you know. And then there are colleagues of mine that go in. Yeah. And we have this agreement with each other. If we really run up against something and we need to talk to each other, we do that.
I'm glad that you're able to have that because I would imagine you're at your most vulnerable in a lot of these moments, and it's good to be able to share with other people who understand. Thank you so much. It's been so informative, and the work that you do is just unbelievable.
Thank you very much.
So grateful for it.
Thank
you
very much,
Patricia. James.
Really, I really appreciate the opportunity to dispel the stigmatism about these people.
Thanks so much to James, and thank you all for listening. We look forward to sharing more inspiring stories on our next episode. If you'd like to know more about James Fox and the Prison Yoga Project, check out his website at prisonyoga.org. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at untangle@gayam.com. And don't forget to check out Meditation Studio by Gayam in the App Store. See you next time.